House Education Finance Committee will come to order, please. All right, we have several bills on the calendar for today, so we will go ahead and get started with our business. Representative Detmer, have you had a chance to review the minutes from the March 24th meeting?
Yes, Madam Chair, I have, and they're good.
All right, so Representative Detmer moves adoption of the minutes. Any questions? All right, all in favor of approving the minutes for March 24th, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Detmer. All right, so with that, we are, I think, ready for our first bill. Representative Fenton, if you want to move to the testifier table. And our page is helping one of the presenters get their computer set for making the presentation. But while you're coming to the table, members, we're going to start with House File 1529 in your packets. And I'll go ahead and move, Representative Fenton moves that House File 1529 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee, but it is the Chair's intention today to lay it over. So we'll be hearing testimony on it. And you do have an amendment, right? A DE1
yes.
amendment in your packet to get the bill in the shape the author would like.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
All right. Any explanatory comments you want to make, or should we just move it and then you can tell us about it?
If we can move it and then I'll go through it and
Very
do the
well.
Presentation.
All right. So the DE1 amendment, members for the House File 1529 to get the bill in the shape the author would like. Any questions? All in favor of adopting the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Kelly Fenton here to present House File 1529 for possible inclusion. Minnesota has a strong history of supporting parental choice in education, and much of this history dates back to the 1970s when the Minnesota legislature made it policy to support high-quality education options for all students, regardless of whether they attended public schools, private schools, or homeschooled. Equity and access to better education options were important features of the policies enacted, from education tax credits and deductions to charter schools and open enrollment. Unfortunately, we've fallen behind in recent times, and our achievement and attainment data reflect the need to catch up. While we have a large share of higher performing students, we have the largest achievement gap between white students and minority students. The statistics are sobering and should serve as an urgent call to action for lawmakers. And just a few of these statistics. The national four-year high school graduation rate for black students is 69%, but is just 51% in Minnesota. The national four-year high school graduation rate for Hispanic students is 73%, while in Minnesota, it's 53%. Minnesota ranks last in the country for four-year high school graduation rates for Hispanic students and the second to last for African Americans. The ACT College Readiness Exam showed that 78% of Minnesota ACT test takers are college ready, with 84% of white students, 55% of Hispanics, and only 39% of black college-bound students considered college ready. As a former public school teacher and school administrator, I support strong public, private, and charter schools. I believe strongly that we need to create high-quality education options in all arenas in order to give parents and students, all parents and all students, the best education system in the country. Just recently, several of our local foundations pooled resources around the initiative called Minnesota Comeback, which calls for creation of high-quality options in public, private, and charter schools. Not just public schools, but private schools as well. We will not succeed with a one-size-fits-all education system, and we need to have individualized learning to meet the diverse needs of our students. And that is why I'm here today to support House File 1529 that establishes education savings account for parents of special education students. School choice gives parents the freedom to choose the best learning environment for their children. It ensures that each child receives an excellent education regardless of race, income, background, or zip code. Innovative ESAs allow parents more customization of a child's education, particularly for special education students. As of this spring, 5 states have enacted ESAs: Arizona, Florida, Mississippi, Tennessee, and Nevada. Arizona's program was first signed into law in 2011 and has been expanded 5 times. 1, students who attend failing schools. 2, students of active duty and fallen military. 3, children in adoptive care. Incoming kindergartners. Children from tribal lands. In Florida, ESAs were enacted for special needs students, as well as Mississippi and Tennessee. And then in Nevada, provides for universal ESAs and was signed into law by Governor Sandoval in 2015. Studies conducted on ESAs in Arizona in 2011 show ESA families are happy with their accounts and utilize funds to customize their children's education. A 2013 student Friedman Foundation study on Arizona's ESA program found that 71% of parents using ESAs were highly satisfied, and nearly 20% were satisfied, and 10% were somewhat satisfied. In Minnesota, a statewide survey conducted in April of 2015 found that over 70% of Minnesotans support ESA for special education students. Parents and the public understand that empowering parents to make decisions results in higher satisfaction and better results regarding education achievement and attainment. So how do ESA work for students and families? ESAs allow parents to receive a deposit of public funds into government-authorized savings account with restricted but multiple uses. This allows parents to customize their child's education and specific learning needs. The state gives parents restricted use debit cards loaded with a portion of their child's share of per pupil funds. They can direct the funds to pay for pre-approved educational services and providers, including private school tuition, textbooks, curricula, online learning, individual public school classes, and AP courses, for example. Parents can roll over the unused funds from year to year and even into college savings plan. So the eligible family receives a restricted use debit card loaded with allotted funds for their child's education. Eligibility is determined by the Minnesota Department of Education. The family uses the card for approved educational expenses and submits the receipt to the Minnesota Department of Education. Debit cards can only be used for accredited, licensed therapists, tutors, and approved private schools. Families may roll over funds to the next year. So I quickly go through the bill language and covering just some that might need next more explanation. But Subdivision 1 is the title, and two, Subdivision 2, definitions. Subdivision 3, the Education Savings Account Program, which I just covered. Subdivision 4 is the funding. Currently, it takes 90% of the per pupil fund plus the some special education allotment. And then also based on 125A.76, depending on the disability category, or it will give $450 for a student with disability that's not included in the statute. For administration of this, the Commissioner of MDE will administer the program and shall create a standard form for parents of students to establish eligibility of the ESA. They can deduct 3% from what is allotted to cover the administration of the program. Subdivision 6, the establishment. Subdivision 7 is the scope. 8, severability clause appropriation. And number 10, program evaluation. The Office of the Legislative Auditor is required to conduct an evaluation of the program in the calendar year 2022. That's 5 years after the administration to determine how effective it is. So I'm now going to turn this over to our testifiers, and we'll answer questions once the testifiers have finished. I want to introduce Adam Peschek.
Thank you, Representative Fenton. And to Mr. Peschek and any testifiers today, if you would please just be sure to give us your name and who you're with before you begin your testimony. We'd have that for the record. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair and committee members, for listening to this presentation. My name is Adam Peschek, and I'm Director of Choice Policy at the Foundation for Excellence in Education. We're a national 501c3 advocacy organization that deals in a lot of K-12 issues, including educational options, which is what I'm going to be talking about right now. So I'm here to kind of give a broad perspective of what's going on with ESAs across the country and how this bill kind of plays into that. But first, I think a little context is helpful. Recently, a year or so ago, a poll was done of 600 registered Minnesota voters, and they asked them what kind of school they would choose for their child if they could, public, private, charter, online, home, whatever. But more importantly, they asked them why they would choose the type of school they chose. And so here's the top 10 answers they gave. This is a word cloud with the larger words representing the things that were mentioned most often. These are just the top 10 answers. There was about 20 or so different things they gave. But on this list, there's a lot of different things. And the point that I want to make is that nothing on this list is wrong. None of these are wrong answers. They're just different perspectives that parents have and different needs that each child has. And a lot of times when we talk about choice, we kind of focus on competition. Competition is going to make everything better. And while there is some aspect to that, I think a more important aspect of choice is the concept of fit. It's the ability to match your child's needs with the environment that fits them the best. So there is no one perfect school, so we can just go ahead and say that no matter how much we fund it, no matter what resources we give it, there's no perfect school because every school has a specific culture, they have specific teachers, they have specific lots of different things that make that school what it is. And the point of choice is to really allow people to match those needs to the environment that fits them the most. So I'm going to go through and skip ahead a lot in the sake of time. So I'm here to talk a little bit about education savings accounts and kind of how they tie in Minnesota. Private school choice has grown for the past 25 years. Basically, it happened the same time that you all created charter schools. Charter schools, private school choice have been kind of moving in tandem at the same time. Where, 10 years ago, there were maybe four programs across the country. Today, there's now 45 programs in 24 states plus the District of Columbia, serving upwards of 400,000 kids across the country. Education savings accounts are really the next kind of generation of school choice because it really moves from school choice to educational choice. So a lot of times people will call an education savings account a voucher or a scholarship. What it really is a multi-use tool that parents can use to direct their funds to a bunch of different things. So on this screen, you can see just some of the uses that states have, everything from private school tuition to tutoring, therapies for students with special needs, which are really important, online courses or programs, instructional materials. So there's a wide variety of things. And the benefit of education savings account is it kind of moves away from this kind of use it or lose it model of education where you have this amount of funding, you can go to that school. If you have funds left over, too bad. If it goes over the amount that it costs to educate you, too bad. This really kind of empowers parents to really think about education in a way that they never have before really in the public sphere. And the key is really customization. The funds can go to the need of the child. And another important thing there is another big thing, is that ESAs are funding the child, not a school building. A lot of times we talk about choosing between school A or school B. Here you can use school A with a little bit of tutoring on the side, with special needs therapy, and it really helps parents figure out what's the best role for the child. Now on this map you can see the activity of ESAs in the states for the past couple of years. The purple states are states that had ESA programs. That's Arizona, which passed it in 2011, Florida, which passed one in 2014, Mississippi, Tennessee, and Nevada all passed them last year. In addition, this year there's been 11 bills filed, or 11 states have bills moving, including you all. And the year before that, an additional six states have bills moving forward also. So a lot of activity in almost half the states there's ESA movement happening. So it's something that's kind of gone from an idea in 2011 to now being something that's being examined a lot in a lot of different states. So where are funds going? I know it's a big concern to people. How are parents using these funds? And the early evidence we have from Arizona and Florida shows that parents in both states, regardless of the fact that they don't have to spend funds in specific prescribed ways, they're both spending funds in pretty similar ways. Between 80 and 85% of funds are going towards school tuition. 6.5 to 8% of the funds are going towards tutoring. A little less is going towards therapies, and you can imagine that that's much more a heavy use for special needs students who are using these to go see speech or occupational therapies, whatever it is. A little bit's going to curriculum, and then about 1 to 2% is going to other features. So in reality, these are really being used in multiple different ways. It's not just going to one school or the other. It's going to multiple different things. And I wanted to put a face to these so that you can kind of understand. It's kind of hard to talk about them theoretically. So here's three different kind of cases in Arizona and Florida, the states that have had them the longest, have the biggest, the longest track record. So the first example, Kathy and Jordan Visser. Jordan Visser has a number of impairments, cerebral palsy, dyslexia, vision impairment. He has motor and sensory processing disorders, a lot of different things that he has challenges with. She was actually, they started in the public school system. She was trying to get specific services for Jordan that they were not complying with, they weren't going with. So she actually hired a lawyer. And another interesting thing to think about is, you know, we talk about how school choice has just been around since the 90s. If you really think about it, the first school choice program was created in the 1970s IDEA law when it said that if you can't find a free and appropriate education, the district is going to place a student somewhere else at district costs in a private setting. And some bipartisan research has shown that about 2% or so of kids nationwide actually use this method. The problem with that method is that it's two-pronged. First is that typically you have to be wealthy enough to be able to pay for tuition out of pocket and wait and hope that a district will reimburse you because an administrative judge says that, yes, you have to be reimbursed. And secondly, you also have to have enough funds to usually hire a lawyer to be able to pursue this method. So this is what happened with Kathy Visser in Arizona. She tried to get this to have this happen. She hired a lawyer for $10,000. And thankfully, this was right around the time that Arizona passed their education savings account law. I said, you know, I heard about this program. It might be able to be helpful to you. She couldn't believe it. She found out that it was the real thing. She went and found it and applied. And she was one of the first 75 parents in the nation to get one of these programs. She tried it at a private school. The private school was a better fit, but it wasn't the perfect fit. So she decided to take it into her own hands. And instead of just going completely at a private school, she's doing a customized approach where she is paying for a state-certified teacher who specializes in teaching students who are vision impaired and have dyslexia. And she focuses on him intensively a couple times a week, and that's really improved his learning experience. She's using it for physical therapy so that he can build his core strength, because when he first started this program, he couldn't even sit up in a chair for more than 3 minutes because of his weak core strength. So he's doing that to build up his abilities. They're using that for piano lessons, software that can help, that is directed towards the child, classes at a local science center, a social skills camp that's helping him develop his social skills so he can be more apt in that area. So that's one issue. Another parent, Arizona, Elias Hines, he has autism. He has really high aptitude in some areas. He taught himself how to play the Nutcracker on piano by himself. He taught himself how to play it, but yet he has behavioral issues that don't put him in a traditional class setting. They tried a number of different things. They tried homeschooling options. They tried private school options. They tried public school options. After 2 or 3 years of stops and starts, they finally settled on this one school that's perfect for them. And now she says, for the first time, Elias is now able to do in 10 years, an entire week of school without someone calling home and saying he had a behavior issue, that he had to pick him up. He's thriving. He's learning robotics. There's a lot of different things that are doing in this private school setting that are different. So that's just to say that there's a number of different scenarios that children are going through, and there's not one school or one system that can approach all of them. There's a number of different things, and being able to find the right fit for your child is what the goal of these programs are. So I'll just kind of start wrapping up, because I know there's a lot of time left for questions. This is frozen. But on your packet, the last page kind of shows a breakdown of the different state programs, so you can compare if you're interested in how your program matches up to the other five programs. I would also say, just really quickly, you know, these programs, often these debates come down to conversations about public versus private, and really ESAs break down that barrier. in the grand scheme of things, the vast majority of children are going to remain in public schools. That's been the case for 15 years of school choice, no matter what the issue is. In a state like Florida that's had a voucher for special needs kids for over 15 years, they've never had more than 7, 8% of eligible students participating. That's because, by and large, public schools are doing a good job at educating those children. These are really for the areas, a few kids, a few families, a small percentage that needs something differently and can't go through the process of trying to get a private placement through the long kind of administrative burden system that has been set up for them. And also, I'd say that every parent that I profiled and everyone else you talk to, they're not saying that they're leaving because public schools are bad. They actually want to send their kids to get an ESA program so that they can do intensive therapies, intensive programs, so that in 3, 4, 5 years, they can go back into the public school system as a general education student. And that's really the goal of these parents, is to try to find ways to have direct instruction that's directed and targeted to them, especially in early years where it's so important. If you can catch some of these disabilities early and be able to target them and intervene, that's going to make the rest of your education experience so, so much better. So this is really just kind of an option that a lot of states are looking at as a way to kind of help facilitate choice for parents of special needs students. So happy to take any questions.
And then we have some other. Thank you. We also have two more testifiers as well. So
very well. Why don't if the rest of the testifiers want to come down? All right, welcome. And again, if you would just state your name and if you're affiliated with a group, state that at the beginning of your testimony. Yeah, welcome.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Melissa Sirik, and I'm from Eden Prairie. I'm a parent of special needs kids. I'm a single mom of 4 children, and I'm here today to tell you about 3 of my children that have autism and special needs. My twin boys are 16, and they both have autism, and as does my youngest daughter, who is 10. They all have a wide range of medical and health issues, developmental delays, and learning disabilities. The last I counted, my kids have 29 medical and therapy providers between the 3 of them. Over the years, as first one of my kids and then 2 and 3 were diagnosed with special needs, it became clear that I was going to need extra help for them to be successful in school. First, I put them in a very small private Christian school that had some on-site special ed support, but it wasn't long before I realized that they needed a lot more than that, than the school had to offer, and few of the teachers were trained to deal with autism and had a very limited knowledge at best. Next, I pursued special education IEPs for my children in our local school districts, and our public school had shockingly little to offer my kids. While the classroom teachers regretfully told me my kids could not keep up or function in a mainstream class, the district tells me that they had not failed enough academically for full-time help. One of my kids who has the most special needs was offered 45 minutes of academic help a week, and that's it. Clearly not enough. The public school later advised my twins, who are approaching high school, that they should not focus so much on academics anymore, but concentrate on life skills in public school in our district. And I was told our district offered only one class for one semester of life skills in all 4 years of high school. Desperate, I pulled my twins out of school and homeschooled them. It was a temporary measure that was not ideal for me as a single mom, and I needed to work, but I did my best to try to teach them and find work from home, and all while I was researching other options for them for school. It was then that I learned about the Academy of Whole Learning. It was a private school for kids with autism and other related intellectual disabilities that had teachers who were experts in autism, and they taught life skills and social skills every single day to the kids, as well as having on-site speech and OT. The teachers knew exactly what my kids needed to learn to be successful, and I immediately enrolled them last year, 2 of my children there last year. The progress that they have made socially and academically there has been unbelievable. So this all seems like a great and happy ending, but all of the special education expertise comes with a very steep price. And I'm a single mom who has not received child support for 4.5 years. Not a penny. Not only do I have 4 kids in 3 different schools all over the metro, but I'm driving up to 100 miles a day round trip to get them to all of their schools and back. and work somewhere in between. I also have a hefty tuition bill that feels like I'm paying college tuition without the option of a loan. And I'm currently working four different jobs right now just to pay the tuition. A bill like this one proposed would literally be life-changing for a parent like myself. It would be amazing to have some of that financial burden eased. I've exhausted every option that we have done, from private school to public school to homeschooling, and I desperately want to keep them at the Academy of Whole Learning when I see what the progress that they have made. The things that they are gaining there are going to mean fewer costs for all of us in the future as they learn to become more independent adults. This bill is not about private school versus public school. It's about what is the best school for each parent's child. And I have decided right now where my kids need to be. They all have special education IEPs that entitle them to services in the public schools that we are not using. And I feel like we should be able to take the money for those services and use it where my kids could learn best. So please consider supporting this bill for families like mine and give our kids a chance at their best possible future. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stark. We appreciate your testimony. And you might want to stay close just in case we have questions after the rest of the testifiers. Is there a Ms. Bruce? Okay. Yep, come on down. And if there are others who had indicated they were testifying, a Randy Ash I have listed. You want to be close by? All right. Welcome to the committee. And please just state your name before you begin your testimony.
Sure. My name is Amy Christensen Bruce, and I am here as a general public member. I live in the Stillwater area, and I have two children with special needs and learning disabilities. My children's learning challenges include autism, ADHD, dysgraphia, and cognitive delay. They both have autism, and they both have multiple diagnoses. My seventh grader is higher functioning and has been doing well at his private school in St. Paul since pre-K. This is mostly because his school, even though not required to, has provided him with an IEP-like plan, including supports, modifications, and accommodations. My fifth grader is lower functioning than his brother and is on his fourth school. His schooling experience includes two different public schools and one public charter school. I could go into stories about some of the problems we faced at these schools, but time will not allow. However, there are two key points that I want to talk about. First, my son was pushed through public school systems, receiving grades of meets grade level expectations for classes that he clearly was not at grade level in, and for classes he hadn't even attended, and I wanted him to learn instead. And because there is so much emphasis on state test results in math and reading, my son was forced, even though I objected, to attend a regular math class, which didn't make any sense to him, and then to attend a supplemental math class, which made more sense to him. Likewise, he had to do the same with his reading classes. It got to the point where he was only attending math and reading, with the exception of maybe 1 hour a day where he could do something else that he liked, like social studies, science, and media. I have a whole child, one that is more than his math and reading test scores, and I want him to have other experiences besides reading and math when he's in school. Our experiences with these public schools included PACER advocates, attorneys, tens of thousands of dollars in attorney's fees, conciliation conferences, and mediations. In addition, it included actions with the Minnesota Department of Education and eventually the U.S. Department of Education Office for Civil Rights. Trying to obtain an appropriate education for my younger son at his former public schools was time-consuming, painful, and surprisingly expensive, and not just for us. The bottom line is that two different public school districts and one charter school failed to educate my child. For various reasons, these schools were not able or not willing to educate him. In addition, I know my child better than anyone. I know that he is capable of learning, and I know that he is not being educated. When he is not being educated, sorry. Like many parents in our situation, my husband and I sought out something different for our younger child. He does now attend a private school. Every day, we drive our fifth grader from near the Wisconsin-Minnesota border to St. Louis Park for school. On a good day with dry pavement and no accidents, I spend 4 hours in the car getting both of my children to their schools. The transportation costs alone associated with getting our children educated are unbelievable, and they don't compare to our tuition costs. Passing this bill will help to alleviate some of the financial pressures we face to get our kids educated. In my opinion, passing this bill is a win-win for both parents and school districts. We parents can choose the schools that are best able to meet our children's needs, and nobody knows their needs better than we do. In addition, it would allow more families to choose the best schools for their kids, not just the families of means like mine. I believe the school districts these students leave will also benefit, because the real cost to educate these children to their true capabilities is likely more than the funds they receive from the state. The districts will experience great efficiencies as well, I believe, because they will have to write and comply with less IEPs. This will result in the district's existing systems working for a greater percentage of students on day one. Finally, the issue is more black and white for me. I don't believe anyone or any organization, including any school district, should expect to get paid for a job they are unable or unwilling to do. In addition, when they deem fit, the public school districts are allowed the choice of sending their students to an intermediate school district. On my side of town, that's Intermediate District 916. I feel parents should have the choice to do the same. For us, District 916 isn't an option because our children are not severe enough, but there are other choices available to us. I have two children to educate right now, and I cannot wait for things to get better for them. And it would be unacceptable to be told that I have to wait for them. I want to close by saying this. Please do not mischaracterize me as a hater of public schools. I myself am the proud product of the Minneapolis and St. Louis Park school districts. Public schools work for most kids, and I really wish they worked for us. If they did, that is exactly where my kids would be. I had every intention of sending my children to public schools, but autism changed anything. While I would strongly prefer not to send my children to schools that are religious affiliated, I would send my children, if needed, to any religiously affiliated school that could appropriately educate them. That's how important educating my children is to me. Finally, in general, it's hard to find someone more left than me on any political issue. I believe the Democrats I always, without fail, vote for and will continue to vote for have it wrong on this particular issue. I suspect that it is probably because they have not had to ever educate a special needs child of their own, especially an autistic child. If you haven't experienced this, you cannot possibly know. I respectfully ask that all of you make educating special needs kids a priority by supporting this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bruce. We appreciate your testimony. You want to just stay fairly close. Thank you. And then Mr. Kroonquist, Scott Kroonquist, wanted to testify. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. And I am here to respectfully oppose House File 1529. AMSD does oppose use of vouchers or scholarships or tax credits or other diversions of public dollars to private schools. I'm just going to highlight three reasons. I could go further, but I'm going to stick to three. Number one, we think the research is very strong that vouchers are ineffective. Studies from the likes of Columbia University, the University of Illinois, the National Center for Education Statistics, the General Accounting Office, the Economic Policy Institute, and the latest, the National Bureau of Economic Research, have all reached a similar conclusion. And that is when you compare students from similar family and demographic backgrounds, students attending the traditional public schools perform as well or better than their voucher counterparts in private schools. The second point I'd like to make is that history also shows that what we really do when we enact these savings account or voucher plans is that you subsidize a choice that is already being made. A study out of Milwaukee and out of their voucher program showed that only 21% of the students using a voucher attended the public school the year before. So again, in other words, you're subsidizing families that were already making that choice. And then the last point, we think that the legislature should really focus on your constitutional obligation, which, as you all know, is the Constitution states that it's the duty of the legislature to establish a general and uniform system of public schools. And we have a hard time seeing how a proposal like this will further that duty. We would suggest that a much higher priority for the committee in the state would be addressing issues like the $600 million special education cross-subsidy that currently exists. And that is just one of the cross-subsidies that your public schools face. We have cross-subsidies in transportation programming. We have cross-subsidies in English learner programming, and the list goes on. So with that, I will stop there, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Kronquist. I understand also the department would like to testify. So, Mr. Corday, if you'd like to come down. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members, Darren Cordy. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Education. I'd just like to thank the committee for allowing us to testify on this bill, and we certainly appreciate the author and the proponent's desire to improve outcomes for students with disabilities in our state. However, we do have some concerns with this bill that we'd just like to share with the committee. We'll start off by saying that the commissioner has a fundamental disagreement with the concept of redirecting public education dollars for private school tuition. There's also some constitutional concerns about whether or not such a program would be constitutional under Article 8, Section 2 of the Minnesota Constitution, which prohibits public money from being used to aid sectarian schools. Setting aside those larger issues, MDE has a number of logistical concerns that we would just like the committee to consider. First, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA, makes a public resident public school district the responsible entity for the provision of free and appropriate public education for students with disabilities. That includes students in non-public schools. Certainly parents with students in non-public schools can choose to decline those services from the school district, but the district still has to offer those services and provide them if the parent wants them. Because the state can't supersede that federal law, this bill cannot take away that parent's right. So while this bill would require parents to essentially sign away their rights to public education services in order to participate in an ESA, such an agreement wouldn't be binding under federal law. So if at any point the parent decided they'd like to go back to the, they'd like to have special education services from the resident school district while remaining at the non-public school, the district would still have to provide those services regardless of any agreement that was signed as a part of this bill. Second, the bill seems to be in conflict with Minnesota Statutes 125A.18. That statute states that no child with a disability may be denied instruction on a shared time basis. Under the shared time statutes, a parent can enroll their child in a non-public school and continue to receive special education services for free from their resident school district. But under this bill, parents with an ESA no longer have that option. They're either enrolled in the public school or they get an ESA. There's really no in-between. So in a way, while this bill purports to increase choice for parents, it actually is kind of reducing choice in that regard. Third, it's not clear that ESAs would provide parents of students with the most complex and severe disabilities with the resources that they would need to ensure that their children receive adequate educational services. There's no provision in IDEA that allows federal special education funds to be converted to an ESA. So as I said earlier, it's unclear from this bill whether a parent with an ESA could accept federally funded services from a school district and continue to be eligible for the ESA. So if ESA recipients can't access federal funds, that would mean that they have to provide all of the required services using only state resources. And this might be possible for some children with less severe, less complex disabilities, but for children with severe and highly complex disabilities, it would be unlikely that ESA funds would be sufficient to cover all of the required services. The state receives millions of dollars in federal funds every year to educate students with disabilities. And this bill would turn those federal funds away and then expect the parents of those children with the severe disabilities to figure out how to fill the gap. Public schools, including charter schools, cannot limit their enrollment based on the capacity to serve a student with a disability. But under this bill, there would be no obligation for the providers listed to accept and serve eligible students with a disability. They can simply turn those students away. Selectively admitting students with a disability based on their disability or turning away students with a disability in their entirety could constitute a violation of the Americans with Disability Act, the Federal Rehabilitation Act of 1973, and the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And last but not least, there's really no system of transparency or accountability to ensure that students with disabilities under this bill are receiving the educational services and due process rights to which they're entitled. Under IDEA, there's a comprehensive system of checks and balances to ensure that students' due process rights are being met. If a public school fails to provide the services that a student's entitled to, a parent can file a complaint. MDE will investigate, we make findings, and then we direct the school to provide the required services, which can include compensatory education hours. But under this bill, none of those checks and balances exist. In fact, MDE is specifically prohibited from using our regulatory authority to protect the due process rights of students. These are the most vulnerable students in our state, and we owe it to them to make sure that their rights are being honored and protected. There's a number of other implementation questions that we have, including our students with an individualized family service plan eligible, our students who exit special education automatically removed from the ESA program, regarding technology expenditures, what is meant by necessary technology, and are there limits on that? Who determines if something is necessary? There's no mention of medical equipment or specialized medical procedures. Are those covered by ESA funds? So again, while we appreciate the attempts of the author and the proponents to use new approaches to improve the outcomes for our most vulnerable students, we do have some serious concerns about this approach and would ask that you not move forward with this proposal at this time. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Assistant Commissioner Cordy. All right, so with that, I think I'm going to open it up at this point to questions. Any questions from committee members? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the first question I sort of have would be for staff. And then I noticed the 90, and I assume that's the 90-10, where we've recently passed things in host versus resident district. And I was curious if there are any other interactions with those things in statute that are host resident, since this is not a normal fit into the district. And then does it affect any of the calculations? We had that one where it talked about using the district and it wasn't really clear whether it was host or. So I assume the 90-10 is from the host resident so that the resident district gets the 10% funding. Are there, maybe you could just enlighten if there are any other interactions that this might have.
Mr. Strong.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, it may be best to direct part of your question to the author, but under the construction of the bill, the amount that the parent takes is the 90% plus the amount that's specified for the special education category. The 10% does not go to the resident or serving school district. There essentially would not be a serving school of district of residents any longer. So in that way of thinking about it, there that 10% essentially would be saved under the design of the bill. But perhaps best to ask the author where the 90% number came from.
So, Representative Fenton, I don't know if you heard the question, but I think Representative Quam was wondering how you determine 90%.
The 10% would stay within the resident school district.
And that's not what nonpartisan staff is saying.
Okay.
But is there, I guess there was a rule of thumb or some way of determining the 90%, or was that just the percentage you settled on in crafting your bill?
This bill was modeled after the previous bills, and that is the same model that they followed with the 90%.
Thank you. Representative Quam?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so the 3% would be taken out of the 10% remaining, or would it be taken out of the 90%? Up to 3% for administering?
Representative Fenton, do you know if
the 3% would be taken from the 90% plus? Oh.
Good. Representative Quam?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this bill is a great intent to try and empower parents. I had been on a Zumbro Education District board, which several small school districts, because we weren't big enough, banded together to be able to supply special ed, ALC, and other programs. And it is a difficult topic. Funding is always difficult. The one thing that was universal is every single one of those parents was involved in trying for the best of their students. In other words, they're going out of the way, going the extra effort, being put in difficult circumstances, trying to get the best education for their students. And I commend the author for trying to find a route to provide parents the options in a difficult situation. And I just wanted to thank the author.
Representative Fenton?
Madam Chair, I just want to say thank you.
Representative Anzales.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for the testifier and then a question for the author, if that's okay. To the testifier, you You really know a lot about special needs children. I was wondering, do you have a Minnesota license, and when was your last special ed teaching experience?
No. Oh, yeah, thank you. No, I don't have a Minnesota license. What I was doing was just reflecting what the parents in the states that have special needs children and what the IEP says, frankly. I mean, so it's basically the IEP is saying that they have special needs and they have specific things that they need to have accomplished, and the parents are going about and finding ways to do that in a better way. So that's, I'm just relaying what the parents in the states that have them are doing with their children.
Representative Manzo.
Thank you. So, sir, you've never been in a classroom with special needs children?
Mr. Peschek.
Yes, thanks, Chair. Not as an official teacher, no, I have not. But I would say that several people who testified here opposing the bill probably have not either.
Then what capacity have you been in a classroom then, if it's not an official capacity as a classroom teacher?
As an advocate, as someone who goes in to observe and research, as someone who looks at different states and goes to see what the models are being used, whether it's charter, public, private.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. And for the author, you know, I too commend you for taking this on. I think in any conversation that we have with school soups and in principals and school board members, special education is one of the first three topics that they all want to talk about. But I'm wondering, wouldn't it be smarter, at least incrementally, to bring about improvement and change if we just simply fully funded the cross-subsidy?
Representative Fenton.
Madam Chair, Representative Onsells, I share your concern about special education funding, and I believe that the federal government should live up to its promise of the money that it the funding, and provide the school districts a greater flexibility. But first and foremost, this bill is really also about opening up another option for parents and their children.
Follow up.
And Representative Ansel, I would also point out that the special education funding is one portion that is actually tied to inflationary component and whatnot. But the federal government needs to live up to its promise.
Representative Ansel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One final question then. So then, can I count on you to support the federal government's role in educating children?
Representative Fenton.
You can count on me in supporting avenues to best educate all children.
Do you support the federal government's role in E-12 education of children throughout the country?
I think there should be some reforms, but I support all types of education and all options.
Do you support the federal government's role in providing funding to the special education cross-subsidy?
I think that they need to live up to their promise, and I would support it if they did.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Dabney.
Quite all right, Madam Chair. I do the same thing on mornings in the mirror. I'm like, who are you?
Well, I keep wanting to call people by their first names, and I'm having to remind myself that we have a certain protocol we follow. So.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair Moon. Representative Fenton, I have not given the bill the full time that it probably is deserving, but I have read through it, and these are public dollars we're talking about, and traditionally when we talk about public dollars, we talk about transparency and accountability. And I'm not seeing in here that these students would be expected, as their peers in the traditional public and charter school options, to take the MCAs so that we can assess publicly whether these dollars are being used effectively or not. Can you highlight to me where in the bill we require the recipient schools to administer the MCA so that we've got public accountability on the use of these public dollars?
Representative Fenton.
Madam Chair, there are components in the bill that do call for audits as determined by the commissioner, just unsolicited, periodic. There are fraud components in the bill, but this will be again based on the avenue that the route that the parents decide to choose, and again with accredited programs that I believe already follow our state laws with the MCA and whatnot.
Representative Devney.
Madam Chair, Representative Fenton, and for one thing, I'm not talking about fraud. I'm talking about, are these schools adequately preparing these students, following the IEP, preparing them to be part of the world's best workforce? Where's the public accountability for the dollars? Not fraud. That's mm-hmm. that's a separate issue. You've got very, I'm sorry to use this word as it applies to you, Representative Fenton, but you got fairly liberal language around fraud. I get to engage in fraud multiple times and keep the education savings account. So I'm a little concerned about the fraud, but I'm assuming that most folks aren't going to engage in fraud. But public dollars should be accountable publicly, and I'm not seeing that in your bill. Am I missing it, or is it just not in your bill?
Sure.
I'm going to turn it over to Adam.
Mr. Pesci.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Representative, so on the fraud issue, there's a difference between mistakenly, the three strikes was for mistakenly using it. So you might go and buy a piece of curriculum that you should not have, and it was an inadvertent mistake. That's the three strikes. There's nowhere in there that says you can commit fraud three times. You commit fraud once, you can be sentenced by the law, the legal system. So that's one issue. On the accountability, the issue about accountability, when we talk about testing accountability in the public schools, it's because there's no other avenues to go to. Okay? So when we talk about accountability, we also have to talk about accountability to who. So if your child is doing terribly on your standardized test in the public school, what is the recourse of a parent? They can try to go get a placement. They can try to get another situation going. In this, the parents who have these programs in Arizona and Florida, they have far more accountability than the public school system, because every teacher, every therapist, every tutor, every piece of curriculum are accountable to the parent. And if they don't like them, for whatever reason, it doesn't even have to be academically, if they don't like them because they're not treating their child well, because they're not giving them the kind of respect they deserve, they can switch that provider instantaneously. And that's what real accountability is. It's not just the data that tests create is data. What you do with that information, that's how you hold people accountable. And with this system, parents are able to hold their provider accountable on a wide area of things. And all the 10 criteria I mentioned, you know, whether it's diversity, the ability to have the right structure in the classroom, the culture of the classroom, to make sure that this child's emotional benefit, well-being is being cultivated. On all of those factors, they're now accountable to the parent, who can make decisions in real time on a day-to-day basis on how they want to have their child educated. So that's, I think, there's probably a lot more accountability in here than there is with a single test.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, you're not getting it. As you pointed out in your own testimony, when it's my money, I tend to be more focused on it. And you're taking my money and routing it around and then not holding the recipients accountable. So you're missing that. Shifting gears, I'm not seeing, Representative Fenton, language in here that would prohibit recipient schools from discriminating. And we've got challenges within the private school system that are well known, of them discriminating against special education students. But I don't see anything in here that cites the Human Rights Act 363A to make sure that we don't have, again, public dollars. Parents get to discriminate all they want. Parents get to make their own decisions. But these are public dollars. They're not just the parents' dollars. I don't see any language in here that prohibits recipient schools from discriminating based on age, sex, race, religion, national origin, immigration status, all of those things, LGBT status, all those things that are covered in 363A, Minnesota's Human Rights Act. Am I missing that as well?
Representative Fenton.
Madam Chair and Representative Dabney, and one thing back that I want to point out to your previous question is, in this bill, the OLA is required to conduct a program evaluation, just in the year 2022, just so you know. But to your question, you know, private schools will work closely with parents to identify special education and customized educational services. Private schools do serve an important role in educating students from diverse backgrounds, and they'll continue to do so. But some private schools may decide not to participate in an ESA program because they don't have the capacity. Again, the key is parental choice, and we need to let parents make the best educational decisions for their children. This may be a public, a private, or a charter school. In regards to the public funds, I think one of the goals of the Minnesota legislature, although we may get there differently, is and our taxpayers, is ensuring that our public funds are used to give parents and students the best education system while it complies with the constitutional requirements. And this bill does accomplish that. The goal should be ensuring that we have a high-quality education system, public, charter, or private school.
Madam Chair, one last.
Representative Dan.
Thank you. Representative Fenton, I do think we share some common goals, but as you pointed out, we get there differently. I recognize the right of private schools to discriminate, whether it's the local church school saying you don't go to our church so we're not going to let you in, or the local boys school or girls school saying, you know, you didn't pass the physical, if it's a single sex situation. I respect that, but that's being done with private dollars. This is being done with public dollars. And when it's public dollars, I don't believe that money should be taken from taxpayers through taxes and then used to discriminate against those same taxpayers when they go there to get educational services. And I don't see protections in your bill to prohibit that. And that's my concern. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Fenton.
Thank you. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Fenton, when I look at the title of your bill, it's like reading Right to Work. You know, educational service account, or the savings account is really a private school voucher. Is that right?
Representative Fenton.
This is different because it is an educational savings account in which the parents are empowered to customize the entire education for their student. A voucher is generally used for one place to go. The money goes to one place. This is about customization of a child's education.
Madam Chair and Representative Fenton, when I think of a savings account, I think of something similar to the college savings account where parents actually put money aside and are able to save money for their college tuition for their students. The parents aren't saving anything here. It's the state that's paying for this entirely. So there is no savings. You're using a voucher to pay for private school.
Representative Fenton.
Madam Chair, Representative Newton, these are, again, it's not necessarily for an individual school. It's for the parents to individualize the education of their child. We have something like this in Minnesota in the terms of health savings account, where you have your debit card and you can use it to refund certain items. So, again, it is different from a voucher. It allows the parent to customize to the individual need of their child. And nobody knows and understands a child better than the parent itself.
And
Madam Chair, yes.
Thank you, Chair. So also the savings component is also that if you have a child who's getting a $10,000 education savings account, a voucher would say that the decision between going to a $10,000 tuition school and an $8,000 tuition school has no meaning because the parent doesn't save the money, the school doesn't save the money, the state doesn't save the money. The education savings account says if you have a $10,000 education savings account and you see between an $8,000 tuition and $10,000 tuition, now that difference actually makes a difference because that $2,000 you can put into therapies, you can put into tutoring, you can put to take an online course, you can put that to do norm reference testing, you can do a number of different things. So that's where I think the savings comes in, is that it allows parents to not just have a use it or lose it situation, it's more being able to economize and figure out where the funds are best met.
Madam Chair, sir, a voucher is a voucher is a voucher, no matter how you use it. And currently, the state is supporting private schools with ELL services, special ed services, school nurses, books, transportation, to the tune of about $40 million a year. How much more will your bill cost the state for this program that you're proposing?
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Newton, because of how I've designed the funding, it's caught no extra cost to the state.
That's interesting. Madam Chair, could I ask Mr. Strom or Ms. Johnson to comment on that?
Mr. Strom or Ms. Johnson, do we have a fiscal note on the bill? We do not.
No. Madam Chair, Representative Newton, under the design of the bill, the money essentially is 90% of the general education money plus a portion of special education revenue keying off the disability category. And that money is transferred into the account, into the education savings account for the person that applies for the education savings account. There may be some misunderstanding here with the 10%, but my understanding was that 90% was the sole amount paid. So for a student currently in the public system, there'd be a 10% savings on the general education money as well as savings on each of the categoricals for any public school student who were to choose an education savings account.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Strom. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Newton. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Could the testifier from the department come down?
Commissioner Cordy.
Mr. Cordy, the last figures I have that in 2012 the cost of state approximately $1.8 billion to fund special education funding. This was back in 2012. You might have the current figures, but according to MDE, of course, the state and federal government only provided $1.2 billion. That left nearly $600 million for the local school districts to make up the difference. In your opinion, what would happen if, say, the federal government provided all the funds that they're supposed to, that they said they would, I think 40% they were supposed to, and then the state 60%. If it was fully funded, I still go back to the two parents that testified here. Would their situation be solved if we had fully funded programs for special education?
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, you know, with the cross-subsidy that Mr. Kroonquist talked about, when you have the state cap and the federal cap, school districts are required to take money out of the general education classroom to fund special education services because they can't deny a student special education services. They're required by law to provide them. Mm-hmm. So by doing that, though, it places a tremendous amount of pressure on the administration and on special education teachers to keep those costs down, and in some of those circumstances it's going to result in services not being provided that parents think that their child is entitled to. Certainly we have a system now where if a parent believes that their child isn't getting the services that they're required to have, they can go through the complaint process and we can make determinations about that. But I think if you fully funded the cross subsidy and you didn't have that pressure of districts having to pull money out of the general education classroom to fund special education services, you might see special education services expand a little bit because there's not that pressure. So I can't say in these specific situations whether it would solve their problem, but I think on the whole, you'd see a greater expanse of services because you don't have this push-pull between general ed and special ed. They're not competing with each other.
Yeah, just, Manager, just to follow up, you know, I spent 34 years as an educator, and I can just imagine parents that constantly are looking for what's best for their child. And I still have to listen to what the parents say. And this is something that the federal government and the state really need to take a look at. Are we failing our all areas of our education, especially with special ed? So, enough comment.
Yeah. Representative Murphy.
Representative Fenton, in the five states that have these scholarship vouchers, savings accounts for the parents, does the Department of Education administer those programs in every one of those five states?
Representative Fenton.
I'm going to allow Adam, Madam Chair, I'm going to allow Mr. Prestwick to.
Thank you, Chair. Representative, of the five states, Arizona, Mississippi, and Tennessee are run by the Department of Education. Florida, it's run by nonprofits for the most part. And then in Nevada, which has not yet launched, when it does launch, it'll be run by the Department of Treasury.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Peschek, in Nevada, does the Treasury Department run the State Department of Education, or is Treasury responsible for the education in the state of Nevada?
No,
Mr. President.
Oh, Chair, thank you, and Representative. No, they run the college 529 plans and college prepaid, but they don't run the traditional K-12. That's run by the Department of Education still in Nevada.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Mr. Peschek, in Florida with the nonprofits, are there individual nonprofits for each school district, or is there a state administration of this savings program?
Chair, thank you, Representative. So in Florida is a very unique situation that they've had scholarship granting organizations in the state for 15 or so years that help run the state's tax credit scholarship program. So the way it works in Florida is that the rules and oversight is still done at the state level. The department still sets rules, but it's the nonprofit organizations. There's two that exist. There could be more, but there's only two that have applied to run. They kind of run the applications, the processing. They verify things with the department. They're really doing a lot of the work that a traditional administrator would do, but it's still overseen by the state government. It's just the nonprofits are running a lot of the day-to-day work. They're helping parents navigate the system, doing reimbursements and that sort of thing.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Mr. Peschek, in Arizona, Mississippi, and Tennessee, in those states that are the State Department of Education runs the savings program, what, in their your knowledge of their experience, then, what has happened to the students that where the parents aren't receiving a student scholarship or voucher? What has happened to the students that are in the program, in the special education programs in the individual school districts, where the parents don't apply for those scholarships vouchers?
Mr. Peschek.
Thank you, Chair. So this is a voluntary program. They would still be in the public school system. You know, we're not pushing kids into the system. This is an option for parents that they want to use. The best example we have, I think, though it's not education savings accounts of vouchers, from Florida with the McKay Scholarship Program for Students with Special Needs. It's been around since, I want to say, 1999 or 2000 or so. 30,000 kids are in the program currently. That's about 7% of eligible kids in the state. Since the time that program has passed, The public school system has received more funding for special needs students. They have more special needs teachers. They have more special needs students. The test scores of special needs students in the public schools have gone up. Studies have been done that show that the prevalence of private options in the area of a public school that has this program shows that the competitive effects work, so that if you have a school near a private school, that those kids are increasing at a higher level than kids that don't have private school options in their area. So all the evidence from the Florida program has shown that not only has funding gone up, has student satisfaction gone up, has parent satisfaction gone up, has student scores gone up across the board. And this is, I can send anyone studies that they want to see on this. So in that case, they've all gone up. Arizona, it's only been around for 4 years. It's still only about 2,400, about 3,000 or so kids are in the program now. It's been around about doubles every year. So it started with, I think, 170, and it moved on to the point where now it's about 2,400. So it grows little by little. And again, this is for the students who need something different that the public school is not providing. It's not something where all kids are being pushed into it. It's really just an alternative for people that's out there for them.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, I think I'm not sure what happened in education innovation in the sense that I'm not hearing properly. This money is separate from the special education money that goes into all of our school districts for the numbers of students in our in that district. Is that correct? This savings account money is separate from the monies that go to the school districts. Representative Erickson, can you help me?
You know, Representative Murphy, I think I'm going to have Mr.
I think staff.
Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, under this bill, essentially the money is defined as a formula amount and appropriated into the education savings accounts. The special education money for school districts keys off a number of factors, including the students served. So if that student's no longer being served by a public school district, the special education funding for that school district is going to go down because it's based on the characteristics and number of special education children served by that district. So there's sort of two separate things going on in the bill. One, if the student leaves the public system, there'll be a reduction to the serving district's revenue because they're no longer including that child in their count. And then there's a separate action that appropriates the money into the education savings account.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Mr. Strom, Mr. Pishak, you said that there were more teachers doing special ed. School districts were better off with special ed, and the parents were happy because they had these individuals' accounts to buy separate things. So how can that all those things happen if the school district is no longer carrying the special education finance money for the students that are enrolled in the savings accounts?
So it happens, Representative, because the small number of students who are participating in this program is outnumbered exponentially by the number of kids who remain in the program. So you have the resources that remain. You have, and in Florida, it just happened that the fact that the enrollments grow, more special needs students were needing to be served, more teachers were getting there. The more the legislature funded, all of these things happened.